This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio. My guest today is none other than Christopher Hitchens, formerly of The Nation magazine, still a contributing writer to Vanity Fair. He's the author of a new book out called God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. Many of you probably know Christopher Hitchens for his support of the Iraq War. But love him or revile him, you can't dismiss him so easily, and he still has, if not one foot on the left bank, at least a footprint on the left bank. So, Christopher Hitchens, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Very nice of you to have me.
Well, let's get right to it. The Iraq War, do you have any second thoughts on supporting it?
No.
Why is that?
Well, I think it was, as well as a just war, a necessary war. In fact, I would, in a sense, want to say an inevitable one. There was going to have to be a confrontation with Saddam Hussein. I thought we should have picked the timing of it rather than he. And there was going to be a maimed and traumatized Iraq in our future. It's a responsibility we couldn't walk around or evade, and I thought it was essential to engage sooner rather than later.
But it wasn't a just war in the traditional teachings of just war, anyway, in that there was no attack or imminent attack, for that matter. So there was really no cause for the war. So what do you mean by just war?
I don't think so. I mean, the Saddam Hussein regime was one of unsleeping aggression against its neighbors. I can back up perhaps a bit. But there are four conditions, it seems to me, under which a state can be deemed to have lost its sovereignty and be open to international intervention to remove its government. One is if it invades the territory or occupies the territory of neighboring countries. The other is if it violates the Genocide Convention, at least for those countries who are signatories to that convention, which we are. It's mandatory to take action either to prevent or to punish genocide. If the said government violates the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and if it gives support, encouragement, and shelter to international terrorist organizations. Now, Iraq is multiply guilty on all those four counts.
It hadn't invaded a country for years. On the first one, it hadn't. I don't want to defend Saddam Hussein. I don't defend Saddam Hussein, and I do think your argument or the argument for people who claimed there was a humanitarian urgency to this isn't something that can be dismissed out of hand. But he hadn't invaded, as far as your first point goes, a country in quite some time.
Oh, but he was in the habit, all right. And he was, in my view, there's no doubt of it. I know it's a hotly disputed proposition, but there's no question in my mind that he was still seeking to rearm with weapons of mass destruction, and that he was very actively engaged in trying to support Islamist terrorism in the region as well. And really the mistake was not to have taken him out in 1991 when the opportunity would have afforded itself.
But I would add,
having stipulated what those four legalities are and principles are, that above all it was important after 2001 to change the balance of power in the Middle East. Iraq's a keystone state.
But this isn't a humanitarian argument, then. This is just a geopolitical, realpolitik
sure.
argument.
Yeah, well, also, it's a war for oil. I mean, don't forget. That oil is very important. And it's not... It's how it was sold by me.
I
wasn't a supporter of it. I was an advocate on it, if you recall. It's very important, yes, that a keystone state between the Wahhabi theocracy of Saudi Arabia and the Shia theocracy of Iran, with both of which we're also going to have some kind of confrontation sooner or later, a keystone state, a choke point of the world economy, in the private hands of a psychopathic crime family, not a situation that could go on for very much longer, or should have been allowed, in fact.
Christopher Hitchens, my recollection is though that you undersold the oil argument and sold the humanitarian argument above all, and certainly Bush wasn't talking about oil until recently.
Well, right? No one's allowed to talk about oil for a reason that I simply don't understand. You heard people saying, you must have seen them, you may even have been one, saying things like no blood for oil, as if oil isn't worth fighting for. I don't understand this at all.
Well, we should go invade another country for their resources.
I thought that was extremely important. Because we want to help, among other things, undermine and undercut the monopoly on oil that is currently held by the Saudi Arabians. And changing the balance of force and power in that way is very important to us. So it should be, anyway. It's certainly important to me.
Well, I must say I'm less persuaded or tugged by this argument than by the moral, Saddam's a terrible dictator, we got to help those poor Iraqis.
Well, there's absolutely no reason to soft-pedal that approach either. I mean, I've been a very passionate advocate for many years now of the autonomy of the Kurdish people of the region, not just in Iraq either, but in Syria, Iran, and Turkey. We had a responsibility, I think, to defend that enclave that we'd helped to create in the north.
And what about Turkey now attacking Iraqis there? Threatening to attack?
Well, I think one thing we can say a superpower is capable of doing is telling the Turks to keep their hands off Iraq, which so far we've been successful in doing. But I wouldn't mind hearing the administration say that a bit more loudly. And I think it's also important that we keep reminding the Turks, as the European Union has been doing, that there is another people living inside their borders, a Kurdish people whose rights must be respected as well.
But it sounds to me like you're kind of recapitulating the Carter Doctrine that, you know, there's oil in the Persian Gulf, it's key to, or the U.S. national security interest, the U.S. can go do what it wants to grab that oil.
Pretty much, yeah.
And don't you feel...
I think that's putting it rather crudely, but I don't have any quarrel with that point of view, no.
To me, I have a huge quarrel with it because I think...
I'll tell you why, because it's for this reason also. As everyone knows, the problem with Iraq up till now has been that it's almost been innately dictatorial, its system, and thus aggressive and expansionist as well, because the Sunni minority, of which Saddam was the clan leader of a minority of that minority, the Tikrit mafia, doesn't have any oil under the provinces where it lives. Therefore, it has to govern the Shia and Kurdish majority by force in order to have access to the oil. Now, since the liberation of Iraq, quite a lot of new prospecting for oil has been done. And for example, in Anbar province, huge Sunni province between Baghdad and Jordan, very big deposits of oil have been found. We'll be able, as well as having done what we've done, offering Iraq a federal constitution and having held two elections, to point out to people that the material basis, the actual economic basis for a federalism now exists. There could be an oil splitting, an oil sharing law. In fact, we're within measurable distance of getting one of those through the Iraqi parliament. I think that's a tremendous achievement, both in stabilizing and civilizing the region and in making sure that those resources are not controlled by criminals and fascists.
Well, what about the fact that the multinational corporations want to go in and expatriate 75% of the oil? And
It's still in advance on having all of it owned by one family. It couldn't be more privatized than when everything in the country belonged to Saddam Hussein.
Christopher Hitchens, this idea that you should be able to invade another country because you think that country is going to be traumatized anyway, and you kind of preemptively go in to make the trauma less, is a kind of a difficult proposition, though, because you'd never know how much trauma you're going to impose, and the United States has imposed a lot of trauma.
It's true you can't know that in advance, but I think the principle is a defensible one. I mean, look, if we had lived up to our promises about Rwanda, which everyone now wishes, well, perhaps not everyone, I don't know what your view is, but a lot of people do feel ashamed of our failure to act on what was a clear appeal from the UN commander on the ground to stop the... Now, I don't know what would have happened, but I'm pretty sure that we would have seen American soldiers, because it would have had to be the United States that led the intervention, maybe firing into crowds of armed Hutu militia. Could well have happened. We don't know. All kinds of things could be on our conscience by now, but I don't think it could possibly have been worse than what did eventuate when we stood there with our arms folded.
But look what happened to Iraq. And, you know, between 75,000 and maybe 10 times that number of Iraqi civilians killed, that's worse than a lot of people imagine.
Yes, but killed by...
Killed by the
forces of our worst enemy, our worst current enemy, the forces of jihad, the parties of God, the vilest and cruelest and most unscrupulous enemy.
Well, Iraq body count...
And an enemy that we are committed to fighting everywhere as it is, in my opinion.
I mean, I don't think you can attribute all those deaths to the extremists. I mean, IraqBodyCount.net says... You know, 75,000 are a direct result of U.S. or British attacks.
I don't see how that can possibly be known. But it's clearly the case that all the violence in Iraq is the result of the attempt by the jihadists to become the successor regime to the Ba'ath Party, with which they've been collaborating now for many years.
Well, all of the violence, certainly some of it, some of it would be resisting an invasion.
They didn't give Iraq one day's break after the fall of the dictator. They didn't give one day's respite to the people to have, after 35 years of war and fascism, just a little time to think, to start publishing a few newspapers, to allow people to get their satellite dishes, which would have been illegal before, you know, tuned in a bit, have a bit of a discussion, maybe talk about an election. No, straight to criminal violence and sabotage, immediately, without pity.
To that, which our defense secretary said stuff happens.
All the deaths in Iraq, all the deaths in Iraq are attributable to that, to the organized, prearranged, actually, collusion between the Ba'ath Party remnant and the jihadists and the foreign fighters who they'd been importing for some years before, who you're quite right to say we underestimated.
Mm-hmm. Christopher Hitchens.
But where have we not underestimated the sheer venomousness of the parties of God? We've underestimated it consistently. It's something I'd like to see put a stop to. And a military victory over those forces in a keystone country would be a wonderful thing to see. And I think we have every chance of beating al-Qaeda in Iraq. Not just beating it, but humiliating it. And I think that's a very, very important objective.
And why do you say that? Because it looks like the United States is bogged down in a no-win situation right now.
It doesn't look like that to me at all. Neither on my visits there nor email correspondence that I get practically every day from soldiers in particularly Anbar province, which is turning out to be the hinge place, where it's quite evident that the local Sunni population has turned on al-Qaeda, asked for help in getting rid of it, and which means that not only can we defeat these appalling people, but we can discredit them in front of a Muslim people. Now, that seems to me to be an extraordinarily important war to be fighting.
But isn't it quite possible that we're discrediting ourselves in front of the Muslim people? I mean, that seems to be
not if it turns right that way. No, not if the Sunni minority, which is the one that has the least to gain from the liberation of Iraq, is coming to the Americans and saying, we need your help to get these bin Ladenists out of our hair. That's an achievement, it seems to me. The evidence also of the surge in Baghdad is so far very encouraging. In the northern provinces, we have a very thriving democratic enclave among the Kurds, which is an example to the whole region. We can continue to hold up this example to the rest of Iraq, say, look, you could, if you liked, keep on fighting till everything looks like Beirut. Or you could have a federal solution, solving your differences by election and drinking from an enormous lake of oil, which we're expanding the size of by making new discoveries. You know, we'll keep on giving you the alternative. But there is the other road of jihadism, nihilism, and implosion. And that's the threat throughout the whole region. We have to take it on somewhere. And I think Iraq turns out to be the place where the confrontations occur.
And it seems, are you prepared or are you suggesting that the Bush administration should take it on in Iran as well?
Well, it's clear to me that the Iranian mullahs think that they can profit from a confrontation with the United States. I don't know what gives them this idea, but it's clear they're looking for one. They're looking for one in Lebanon, where they're trying to destroy Lebanese democracy with their Syrian proxy. Excuse me. They're looking for one in Palestine, where they're trying to do to the Palestinians what they've done in Lebanon, Hezbollah proxy there, and by making an agreement between Israel and the Palestinians impossible. They're trying to do so by breaking every agreement they've ever even talked about signing on the question of nuclear weapons. And they're looking for a confrontation by sending death squads to countries as far away as Argentina and London to kill people who they don't like the look of. I hope very much that their nuclear resources, their nuclear, what am I talking about, not resources, their nuclear facilities are demolished before they can produce a weapon. And if that has a ripple effect or can be hoped to generate one that would demolish the theocracy as well, I would applaud at the top of my lungs.
And my view is that if Bush goes ahead and bombs Iran, that he's going to compound the problems the United States has throughout the Muslim world, because people are going to say, look, it's another Muslim country the United States is attacking.
Well, another theocracy with which we've had a confrontation. That would be nothing compared to having apocalyptic weapons in the hands of a messianic regime. With that, we cannot possibly coexist.
Although
there is no coexistence with that.
Well, Anthony Zinni, who was head of the Central Command, said we can deter them just as we deterred, you know, Khrushchev and Stalin.
Well, that shows what a fool Zinni is and always has been. That's precisely the difference, that we're not dealing with rational people here. We're dealing with people who think the 12th Imam is on his way back.
But, even if Iran gets one weapon...
And people who have
that would be just national suicide, though, and they must know that.
Yes, but the suicide is the highest form of honor for people like this. As you know, it's their muse. It's what they dream of. They say, they openly say, where they prefer death to life. They say that's why we're weak, because we don't see the gorgeousness of death. And, I don't think a regime that thinks like that should be in possession of apocalyptic weaponry. I think it's irresponsible to allow any doubt to be expressed on this score.
But then the kind of international system that you are positing, Christopher Hitchens, is one where basically the United States can go essentially attack almost any country that it has a huge disagreement with if that country is wanting to get a nuclear weapon and has a bad human rights record.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
So that's just one...
I mean, it's your phrasing of it. My phrasing would be different, but you haven't said anything I disagree with.
My guest today is Christopher Hitchens. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I wanted to get your evaluation of the Bush, of the president, George Bush, especially, and maybe this can be a hinge into your new book, God Is Not Great, his invocation of God rather frequently. I mean, he has said in the Iraq context that we're delivering the gift of freedom there, but it's not our gift to deliver. It's the gift of God Almighty. So he makes himself out to be God's little UPS man or FedEx delivery boy. And doesn't that concern you?
Well, the president's rhetoric on religion, of course, gives me piles, hemorrhoids, as does all such rhetoric. I mean, the ghastly things said by John Edwards and Barack Obama particularly, and... Hillary Clinton, have exactly the same effect on me. I think Bush is probably less pious than they are. I remember feeling such a wave of revulsion at the sermon given by Billy Graham after September 11th, 2001, at the National Cathedral, for example, with the entire political class clustered to hear this goon and demagogue and Jew-baiter fanatic talking about how those who'd been murdered in New York had gone to paradise. I mean, it's nauseating, all this stuff.
I mean, the idea that Bush says he's carrying out God's will. I mean, he did tell these.
I think it's quite clear that he does not say that he's on a mission from God or God tells him what to do.
Well, that's not
true,
though.
He's a fatalistic Methodist. He says things like, "You get to the point where you can do no more, and it's all in God's hands." He would have made a very good Muslim, and of course, if he'd been born in a Muslim country, that's exactly what he would be.
There's the story out of Haaretz, though, that at the time previously where he was trying to fleetingly engage with the Palestinians, that he told Palestinian negotiators that God told me to go to war against Afghanistan and God told me to go to war against Saddam Hussein.
Yeah,
and
I don't find that story very convincing. I've read it. It doesn't sound like him. He's much more, it's much more like this. He says, Jesus got me off the drink. Okay. He says, when I looked into Vladimir Putin's eyes and saw he was wearing his grandmother's crucifix, I realized, you know, this was a good man, a person of faith. He says we should teach the argument about evolution by natural selection versus creation. Actually, there isn't an argument, as you know. This kind of soft center stuff. No, there's no sign at all that he considers himself to be evangelizing for God in his foreign policy.
I disagree with that, but that's just as well. Tell me about the book and why you wanted to write God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything.
Well, I thought that there was some sign of a change in the zeitgeist, especially in the United States, a willingness to resist religious and clerical bullying and to call it by its right name around the world and at home. And so I thought, well, up till now, most of the people taking up this challenge have been great teachers in the natural and human sciences, like Professor Dawkins and Professor Dennett and others, where I'm not qualified, but I might be able to make a more general lay argument on why it is that religion is bad for you.
And some of your points, are quite blunt, like religion is child abuse. Do you want to articulate that?
Well, yes, it's child abuse in several ways. One is, of course, its obsession with mutilating the genitalia of the newborn, which I have a special chapter on. The second is terrifying children with lies about hell, or even worse, in a way, with lying promises of heaven. The third is telling children that they are Muslim or Catholic or Protestant or Jewish or whatever it might be, when really there's no such thing as a Muslim child. I mean, the parents may be Muslim, but they can't say the kid is, but the kid is told that, and also told you that means you're better than other people. Same if you're a Southern Baptist. Or that's, in my view, to maim and stunt children. And that's a sketch of what I think about the child abuse factor.
And you also go through, you know, chapter and verse showing inconsistencies and incredible probabilities in scripture of the three monotheistic religions.
Yes, well, it's clear enough, I mean, what I say at the outset, that looking at this stuff, it can't possibly be the word of God. It's very obviously man-made.
Now, there's a bit of hope in the book that people will overcome this to some extent, though there's a tension. You think now people have the capacity, they don't need to rely on these superstitions anymore because of the advance of science, and yet you say there's something in the mind, there may be something in the mind that inclines people to believe this, and we've got to get over that. What is that in the mind that inclines people to believe this stuff?
Well, we are pattern-seeking primates, mammals, and that's a good thing about us, that we look for patterns. Because it helps, along with our inquisitiveness, it helps us to innovate and to make discoveries. But it has a downside, because if you look for patterns, you're very likely to find them. And we often prefer a conspiracy theory, say, or a bum theory, to no theory at all. And religion is what we came up with when we didn't know very much, when we were in the fearful childhood of our species. We didn't know we lived on a round planet that went round the sun. We actually thought the reverse. We didn't know there were microorganisms that could kill us. We didn't know why there were earthquakes or tsunamis or other catastrophic events. They were all mysterious and frightening to us. So religion is our first and therefore our worst explanation, first for the natural order and second for human nature and so forth. Because it came first, we're stuck with it. It has quite a lot of influence on us still.
Someone reading that.
And people are afraid of death.
And it gives a happy ending for people.
Yeah.
You know, when I'm a longtime atheist myself, so this is cold to Newcastle to me, but one thing that I hear from people is, you know, you can't be condescending to people who have religious beliefs. You're turning people off. Don't make fun of them, respect their rights. How do you respond to that? Because this book does heap some scorn.
Well, I just don't respect it. I mean, I think it's laughable much of the time and hateful much of the time, and not much in between. I think it calls on the worst in human nature, on the most self-centered, the willingness to believe that God has a plan for you, and then to call that modesty, extraordinary. It's also that's the arrogant bit. There's also the servile bit. You know, you're nothing but a worm conceived in original sin. Quran says you're made out of a clot of blood. Bible says you're made out of dust. All this kind of thing. Grovel. That's not good for you either. It's based on organized lying, wish fulfillment dreams. It's thoroughly unwholesome.
Well, you say thoroughly unwholesome, but then people who are knowledgeable about progressive social change in the United States will instantly grab Martin Luther King off the shelf and say, here is a great man.
Yes, I go out of my way to try and attack that very cult. Not that one would want to say anything against the character or the fortitude of Dr. King. But I think it's a pity, the more one looks at it, that he felt he had to phrase what was a perfectly good demand, the demand for equal rights for black America, in religious terms, in terms of the Book of Exodus. Fortunately, he didn't take the Book of Exodus literally, otherwise he would have said that his people were entitled to kill, enslave, scatter, and dispossess anyone who got in their way. And after all, people like A. Philip Randolph, the great labor union leader, and Bayard Rustin, great black socialist, the people who actually organized the March on Washington, had made the essential case in secular terms for civil rights
Do you suspect he wasn't sincere in his religious beliefs?
Well, I can't say I know that. I mean, I know it should be remembered, though, that he was attacked by the FBI and others a lot at the time for having what were called communist associations, and a lot of his friends certainly were secularist and socialist types like Bayard Rustin and Philip Randolph. So there's some reason to think that he may just have thought, well, the language of the pulpit nonetheless mobilizes people. And of course, the church is very strong in the South, and Christianity is very strong in the South. And
the language of the pulpit, at least, and you talk about this in your book, Christopher Hitchens' God Is Not Great, with King's speech the night before he died, that language still speaks to you? Or
it can't not. I mean, no one who's brought up like I am on the King James Bible cannot be stirred by certain references in it. But here's the other bad consequence. As well as having written out of our history the contribution of the great black secularists of that time, which I think is a bad thing and a loss, there's a gigantic condescension now, which I find almost 100% among white liberals and radicals, that, oh, well, these black guys and gals, they seem to like the pulpit. They like preachers. That's their culture. So, in consequence, any fraud who can put the word reverend in front of his name is appointed as the spokesman for black America, and you get Jackson, and now qualitative degeneration, Sharpton, who is, you know, I would say, a man of less caliber than the late Jerry Falwell. But it's all fine because he's the Rev. This is not a good thing. So not all the consequences of Dr. King's leadership, or not all of the assumed consequences of them, are as decorative as some people would like to have you think.
There have been societies, socialist or communist governments, that tried to outlaw religion. That didn't end happily either. What is your rebuttal to that?
Only one communist state actually proclaimed itself officially atheist and made the practice of religion illegal. That was Albania under Enver Hoxha. And that didn't work. The church was given a hard time by the Bolsheviks, of course, and by Mao Zedong, such as the church in China wasn't so strong, but religion in general. Though the Russian Orthodox Church was always kept on hand by Stalin. He knew he needed one. In my opinion, Stalin wasn't an atheist in any case. I think he was a superstitious quasi-believer.
Serious is...
No, it's not possible to get rid of religion by coercion, and shouldn't be thought of, or let alone tried.
But your point in the book is, you know, leave me alone, I'll leave you alone.
That would be my offer if I thought there was any chance that the religious would accept it, yes.
Is there a chance?
No. It's innate in them, I think, to be proselytizing. Where they can, they will try and say they want, well, for a start, they want to be tax exempt, right? Well, I don't know why on earth they should demand that. Then they want their morality legislated. You say, well, biblical teaching should decide what we say about everything from capital punishment to homosexuality. No, it shouldn't. They want to spread the word in other countries. Mother Teresa is there to use helpless people as propaganda for Catholicism. A disgusting idea. I mean, the idea that missionary activity is to be recommended is something I can't see that anyone can't see through that. And then, of course, we have always before us the example of jihadist Islam. Now, to say nothing of messianic Jewish settlers on the West Bank who think that they can bring on the Messiah and the end of days in their own way as well. So there's not much chance that we're going to be left in peace by these people.
Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. My guest today with a very fun conversation, Christopher Hitchens, the author of God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. Christopher Hitchens, it's great to see you again.
Very nice to be back.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.